we welcome in our friend, author Colin Fleming, who, if you don't hear him on the show, you can catch him early in the morning sharing a Pepsi with some hardworking Boston City employees.
Well, that you can, Kimball. You're referring, of course, to the 12, no less than a good dozen, Boston City employees, as you mentioned, who took over an hour to stand around, hands on hips, nominally sweeping the stairs, a job that either a child or 0.25 of an adult could have done in about 10 minutes. So a lot of not exactly highway robbery, but stair-based robbery right outside of the hub of this city's government.
Did they at least move out of the way for you?
Oh, that's right. I sent you that. Yeah, I took a photo. Did you see that? Did you see it? Remember that time years ago when I'm like, you know what people do, Kimball? They eat the space. That was a textbook image of people eating the space. Stairs. They're fairly wide. Three people. And I'm there first, okay? And they see me. They know what's going on. They know me, too, probably, from my routine. And they get up and they flotilla style, three aside at the top, and they block my way. So I had to move. I had to go to like a different set of stairs where there was this guy cranking death metal and drinking from a giant like Econo sized vodka bottle at 9 a.m. and I despair. It's never just the stairs when you're out in the world, man. It's like a lot to bring you down. And at the risk of going off, it bothers me so much, Kimball, when people don't do their job. And it doesn't matter to me what that job is. It makes me murderous. Like, it really, at the Starbucks today, right, before I came on, they didn't have the coffee made. The barista hadn't done her job. I'm just getting the black coffee. And so it's an inch short because it wasn't there. I was like, we're not doing this. I'll wait. You can bring it over. Thanks.
Starbucks, you would think having coffee would be maybe item one on their list of things to do.
To be fair, I'm like a coffee dinosaur. I mean, you've maybe noticed this. I know you've been to a lot of coffee shops, traveling around doing games. But a lot of people don't order hot coffee.
No.
I think it's kind of like a rarity. And especially like whatever this was, 3:30 in the afternoon, they probably think that they're done, right? Like, people are incredulous. The employees are incredulous when you order a hot coffee. It's like most people don't even get coffee when they get coffee, as we've talked about. They dump in like four pumps of this and seven of that. But it's like they're taken aback when you ask for the hot coffee, and they were just clearly trying to get through the rest of the day with this burned coffee. But it's like, I don't care. I know that so long as the coffee's only been out for 3 days, that there won't be mold on it. That's really all I'm looking for, but I want it full.
Colin Fleming here with us on Downtown. All right, we've dispensed with the coffee talk and the state of the working men of the greater Boston area. Let's talk about a little West Coast rock and roll, 1960s, or perhaps more accurately, San Francisco area rock and roll of the late 60s.
Yeah, I guess they were all pretty focused around San Francisco. I keep this big list of potential topics, and so there are all these West Coast bands in there, and I thought I should probably divvy this up and start with like five key records. I don't think we've talked about West Coast bands that much, and there's actually quite a bit of range with the whole San Francisco late 1960s sound that I think can be pretty surprising to people. And also, you end up having these bands that they get lumped in too easily with the whole hippie counterculture sort of thing from that time period. And you can fail to realize how strong their artistry was. And it's always just been something I've been ashamed of. Like, we've talked about how I went so much of my life really not knowing what I should have known about someone like the Grateful Dead. But I think there are other groups from that time period, like, for instance, Quicksilver Messenger Service is a really good example. I think even just from the name, people are going to think that, I don't want to do this psychedelic stuff, and it hasn't aged that well. I really bet. But one of the albums that I mentioned to you was Happy Trails. And that's just this dynamic, postmodern slanting of what rock and roll had been in rhythm and blues had been 10 years back or so with Bo Diddley. I mean, so much of that record is comprised of this just kind of post-modernization of that primal shave and a haircut beat, but with this psychedelia virtuosity from the dual lead guitar attack.
Yeah, well, let's talk more about that, because that album, I had not heard it before. Recorded some of it at Fillmore East, some at Fillmore West, but it really showed a whole lot of different influences from early rock, lots of Bo Diddley covers, but some jazz elements, some psychedelic rock, some folk influence as well. And it really shows off the musicianship of everybody in Quicksilver Messenger Service, especially when they do a lengthy version, all of one side of the album, a version of Who Do You Love?
Who Do You Love? Yeah, that's pretty crazy, that extended. And the thing about Bo Diddley was, when you listen to the lyrics of Who Do You Love, Bo Diddley was really feeling it, wasn't he? Like, he wasn't just like feeling some oats. He was spitting some oats right back at you. He was talking in like this Book of Revelation type of language. And so like a confident young man just spitting out these awesome images and boast in the form of images and feeling invincible. And that was something that Quicksilver Messenger Service, they tapped into, because you would have thought this is pretty minimalist. It's really reductive, the Bo Diddley beat. You wouldn't be able to stretch it into this psychedelic Baroque piece, which is really what they do. If you look at the cover of the album, I think it tips you off too. It's like straight out of a Western. Like if it was the first, like the title card of a John Ford film, you'd buy into it, that you're going to have these happy trails and the Old West and all of that. But the Old West was the age of exploration. I think that's what they were really getting at. What hurt Quicksilver Messenger Service in a way, and it's always surprising, it's always surprised me when I first started listening to this album, like a long time ago. It came out in 1969, and you really like think it's going to be an early 1968 sort of record. And someone might say, well, what's the difference? They're so close to each other. Back when people actually made things that were good, things happened fast. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like a half a year was equal to, I don't know, 25 years right now. And so things were changing so rapidly, and you could almost miss your market. And I think that it would have behooved them if that had come out earlier than it did, because by 1969, you can even sort of argue that the 70s have started by then. I mean, really, when we get to Woodstock in August of 69, that essentially ends the decade. I mean, maybe if you want to say like Altamont with the Stones, but in Quicksilver Messenger Service, they weren't a 70s band. I know that they go on and everything, but really like 68 was like the meaty part of the curve for them.
And they were playing at a time when you had the growing FM freeform radio movement, Tom Donahue and others in San Francisco, but you didn't have a similar thing happening on the East Coast at that time. And maybe that's one of the reasons why they never achieved the level of fame or popularity of Dead or The Doors or Jefferson Airplane. And they also, they weren't a singles group at all.
No, you also didn't have to be a singles group, though. I mean, for instance, like Zeppelin is just as non-singles a band as you can be. And then there were other groups who didn't have much success, even though they were putting out singles. I think it would have been tremendously exciting to experience that on the radio at the time. It's a bit different, but it was probably the early 90s, and I remember I was up late listening to the radio on the East Coast, and just some wayward middle-of-the-night DJ played like some bootleg material, and I don't know, maybe it's like his last day on the job or something like that, but it was also like 2:30 in the morning. I think I'd finished listening to like WFAN, and there was just so like you were in on something verboten, but thrilling at the same time. Not just because you were in on the taboo, but because the music was like it was unleashed. It had been freed. It was really exciting, and so to hear something, an extended number from, I don't know, the cover of Mona, another Bo Diddley song from this album, by Quicksilver Messenger Service. That just would have, to hear those tandem lead guitars going at it like that, and you have these other numbers that it wouldn't seem like a record where there's a folk influence, but a number of the song structures actually belie that sort of folk feeling. And so there just was a lot going on. A lot of it's live. Some of it's kind of live in the studio, so like not really live and collage-y, but cohesive. I just think it's an awesome record.
Yeah, it's terrific. If you haven't heard it before, man, it's worth a listen. Do it at night. I don't know. That's when I did it. I just turned off the lights and listened and got immersed in it, and it was great. Well, you've changed my opinion over the last couple of years of the Grateful Dead, because I think like some people have done, you pigeonhole them and you don't give them a chance, and then boy, when you listen to them, especially live, you realize the depth of their musicianship. And what a great live recording this is, from 1969 in Monterey, the summer of 69. With some just killer performances of Love Light, Dark Star. It's just great.
I think of this as the Turn On Your Love Light concert. And the reason I say that is that people who know the Grateful Dead will know that they could just go off on this song, Turn On Your Love Light, with Pigpen singing lead vocals and extemporizing and going into this whole sermonistic type of deal with the audience. And the Grateful Dead they're one of the few, I sort of buy into this. I feel like there is something about them. I don't mean, I'm a Zulu warrior, so I'm like the least hippified person there is. But I think there is something about them that there's a genuine goodness there that does help you make you a better person. I really believe that they believe that, and that comes through in their art. And what happens at this particular show is that number is interwoven really pretty much throughout. Like, there aren't other Dead shows where that happened. So they were so unpredictable. You didn't know what was going to happen. And sometimes when we say, oh, guy's really unpredictable, you're thinking, is it going to show up drunk? Is this going to suck? You don't know how that's going to be. But it was always good unpredictability with them. And just the tone that Jerry Garcia had with his guitar in 1969, it's a different tone from 68, it's a different tone from 70, 71, 72, really different from like 74, even that much more different from 77. Like, you just, the soundscapes that this band was able to realize and transport you to and escort you through, and there's a version of Dark Star, and you have so many wonderful soundboard recordings from them, because of course that was the thing. They had the right people around them at different times who were tending to all of that. And I'm not saying that they're the best band ever, but there are only a certain number of bands where I hear something from them and they cause me to think on that given day, this might be the best band ever. The Beatles do it. Joy Division does it. Sometimes the Stone Roses do it. The Grateful Dead do it. Not really a lot of bands ever caused me to have that sort of twinge, if you will.
Yeah, and you, I think you can almost feel that sense of community as well when you hear them play, because you know that they're acknowledging the audience, and you just feel that sense of everybody being there on that journey with them.
The way that these guys were interconnected. And we've talked before about how people go on Twitter and they just say whatever about sports, and they're probably losing all their money right now because everyone fancies themselves an expert. And they just say crazy things. Like, I saw someone saying that, oh, Larry Bird, he was the least athletic player ever. It's like, how? You can go on YouTube and watch a game. Like, how could you reach that conclusion? People do a version of that with the Grateful Dead. They're like, in 1969, these guys were sort of like amateur musicians. I listen to something like this and I think, does anyone know anything? How could you hear this and think that all of these guys, I mean, Phil Lesh on bass, he's like Jimmy Blanton with the Ellington Orchestra. He's that good. You can't play rock bass, if you want to call it rock bass, better than this guy does. And they're all some version of that, and they're all interconnected. I mean, it's stunning. It really is. The level that these guys were able to go to nightly is, I mean, just to me, it's one of the most fascinating occurrences in all of American art history, frankly.
From there, we move to a live album, the first live album by Jefferson Airplane from 1969. Another one recorded at Fillmore East and Fillmore West, Bless Its Pointed Little Head. And this is interesting because we were talking about singles bands earlier, and Jefferson Airplane had been sort of viewed by some critics as a singles band. And then they came out with this album, longer versions, a little bit harder edge to some of the music, and yet still nailing some of those great harmonies.
Oh, yeah. Like if you're talking Surrealistic Pillow and you're listening to that, and that was obviously a big hit album, you really get the folk influence on that particular record. If you then listen to, I mean, the version of Plastic Fantastic Lover on this live album is one of the most dynamic live cuts I've ever heard. It is markedly different from its studio counterpoint on the aforementioned LP. Marty Balin, it's like rap. The way he is spitting out these words, the words are so fast, and he's doing them all in this rapid succession, and yet he's enunciating clearly this sort of postmodern song-based Valentine to his really cool record system and audio setup. And he's talking about the man and the machine are like partners in society. I mean, well, talk about like prescience, right? The bass from Jack Cassidy is, speaking of bass, you hear that dun, like that rumble that starts it. And then just the guitar, it's spitting like the same kind of funky venom. I mean, really, like, have you heard that? And it's so loud. Like, it practically, like, billows your shirt as you're listening to it. It gives you that sensation. So if you thought, like, okay, these guys are popsmiths with a folk element and a kind of a trippy vibe, and then you heard this, I mean, it's heavy. It's like, who heavy?
And you also heard some strong elements of what would eventually become Hot Tuna.
Yeah, you do. And they're another band like Quicksilver Messenger Services. They go on and they do stuff. And they're around for a long time. But for me personally, I never really went much further with these particular acts than the prime. Like we talk about, you know, how people argue about baseball players and prime and peak and what's the difference between all of those things and who has an extended peak and a prime's longer than the peak. I feel like that these bands and their crucible moments, they figured out what they most were. They became other things after that, and that's fine. It's almost like the Beatles with the solo careers. I just tend not to be, I don't need to hear like some George Harrison solo album from whatever, 1974. It just doesn't really do anything for me, and it never has. I think when certain artists, like, the better you are, the longer you sustain a moment, and a moment can be a life, really. But it doesn't have to be. And I think these particular bands, Quicksilver and Jefferson Airplane, when you hear them when they were at their best, you're getting everything you need. I mean, you're free, of course, to search out for more, but I don't think it comes up to the same mark.
All right, let's move from a Jefferson Airplane to the recording of Rock Is Dead by Jim Morrison and The Doors. Is it self-indulgent? Is it true art or some combination of both?
Oh, I think it's brilliant. I don't think there's any flab on it. I listened to it again the other day. It's an hour and 4 minutes long. Backstory. Band goes out to, it's like around the time of Stock Parade, they go out to Mexican restaurant, they have a nice meal, they have some tequila or whatever, they come back to the studio. And the dream of the 1960s was something that it faded fast, because on the West Coast, like when George Harrison went out there using the Beatles, you're just seeing all of these kind of homeless drug addicts. It's like pretty sad. He wasn't into it. And the scene just soured quickly. And so Jim Morrison and The Doors, and Morrison especially, was crestfallen by that you had these almost slum type of situations. And the same rock press that had praised The Doors' before, because everything is just usually so fake, now had no use for them whatsoever. So there's this hour-plus-long performance piece, which I think is pretty tight. Morrison's pretty good. He was tighter in terms of his vocals and his delivery during this than he was sometimes during lengthy performances during their concert career, even when they were pretty good. You get Surf, you got Sam Phillips and Son, you have Rockabilly. All of this in this giant, just sort of maximalist, but rhythm and blues-based statement about where rock was. There's humor in it. The playing is, as I said, cohesive, surprising. Parts of it sound like they've been worked out ahead of time, but you know they haven't been. To me, like, if you just said you have an hour of Doors that you can keep, I would go with this, personally.
I found it interesting, too, that he be pretty bold in attacking any kind of a political influence from rock music, anything that wandered into that territory.
He sounds smarter on this than cynics might think Jim Morrison to be. I think he's just kind of this guy who did doggerel poetry and all of that. He sounds like a rather astute, intellectual young man on this. He sounds like he knows what he's doing. Sounds like he knows what he's thinking, why he thinks it. There's no shock value. They weren't really planning this for anything. Sometimes, like, when you make things without any pressure, I think that's, like, whenever I write something, I never feel pressure. I don't. And I think that's important for you to be at your best. And the more you can be that way, the better it is for you and for your work. But people tend to feel pressure a lot of times, and the Doors were included in that group. But I don't feel like they felt any pressure here. I just feel like they were doing their thing, and it came out really well. Well, it didn't come out for a long time. It didn't come out to a few years ago in full on that deluxe edition of the Soft Parade. But it was rumored. You kind of heard about this. You heard fragments of it. They didn't get the whole 64 minutes. And then when it came out, it's like, I don't know. Just stuff seems to be lost on people. I think these are, like, fairly exciting things. And even, like, music people, like, it's like they don't even notice. And when this came out, I was like, wow, this is awesome. I cannot wait to hear this.
Do you think Morrison had in mind, because you've talked about it, when you write, you're thinking about the person who's going to read the book. Was he thinking about an audience that would hear this eventually, or just who was there in the room at that moment?
I think he was, but he wasn't, like, directly. Sometimes you just factor things in. Mm. It's part of the mindset. When you hear this now, like, if you sit down and you listen to this, like, with headphones on or something, there is very much a feeling that you're being spoken to, addressed, that you're not just dissecting some relic from a bygone era. It hits. It hits hard now. It's germane. So I think that had to have been part of his artistic mindset at the time. And Lord knows that he could certainly be flowery and tangential and everything. But the Doors, and we lose sight of this, the Doors really were a blues band. They were a blues rock band, if you want. But that was their thing. When they were the end from the first LP, it's a raga, yeah, but it's also fundamentally the blues. They were always a blues band when they were at their best. They got away from it with Soft Parade, but at the same time, they're doing their bluesiest stuff in this, which is pointing the way to the likes of the L.A. Woman album, which is totally a blues album. I mean, there's really no other way to classify it.
All right, finally, we talk about a recent issue came out last year, Creedence Clearwater Revival, live at the Royal Albert Hall. We talked with Cosmo Clifford about this when it came out, and he said, hey, this was us at the absolute top of our game as a band.
Yeah, this would be the spring of 1970, so they've had a bunch of albums come out, most of their best albums, and their sets they weren't padded. There was no fat in this particular experience. Creedence Clearwater Revival, it's almost strange to think of them as a West Coast band, right?
Right.
They were. But you have bayous and you have catfish and I don't know. It's like makes me think of you when you head down south each year to go noodling, right? So, but it's almost like the band. You have these Canadians and it's okay. The night they drove Old Dixie down, it's like, why do you care so much about the American Civil War, right? Why are you so invested in that? And that was Creedence, but they were another Bay Area band, and they were very meat and potatoes. They were, talk about harkening back to the early days of rock and roll. That's what they did. They did it 10 years after did it, British band, but that's where their name came from. They were referring to 10 years earlier when rock and roll started, and that was very much where Creedence fit in. And like I said, there just was no wasted motion, no wasted notes. At a concert like this, the songs are tight. Many of them are singles, well-performed, energetic. John Fogerty is doing his thing, singing the way he sings. But man, when you come to that last number, which was often the last number of a Creedence show, Keep on Chuglin', it's however long it is, what, right, 10 minutes? You hit the end, you want to go right back to the beginning of that. That is fiery, that's intense, that's guitar solos you can dance to. I mean, that's what you want. They're all firing on the requisite cylinders for that one. The rhythm section guys are doing their thing. John Fogerty's going crazy on the harmonica. Just really extended numbers. Like if someone's like, I don't like long versions of songs, start them with that one. And they'll be a little more open to some other things, I think.
Let's listen a little bit to the guys doing Bad Moon Rising. Doug Clifford told us, you know, the Beatles had just broken up, but we felt like we were the best band in the world at that point. And then, you know, their run ended pretty quickly. Within 2 years, they were over.
Yeah, like I said, they only have one really sort of classic album after this particular show. And yeah, they burnt out pretty swiftly. And the reason I assume he would have said that is because they didn't have any weakness in their game. They could do the albums, they could do the singles, and that just sounds like a given, right? But it really isn't a given. I mentioned Led Zeppelin before. Everyone, Led Zeppelin 4, it's just an album. Do you know what I mean? It's like Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, album. It's someone like The Who, who's next? Yeah, okay, there's stuff released as a single, but album. There weren't a lot of bands who did both. I guess you could say that Creedence cheated a little bit because their albums and their singles, there was considerable overlap. You didn't really get that with the Beatles, but they had those short, for the most part, sometimes they'd stretch out, punchy numbers. And they were doing something different, too, with their singles, that you didn't have these songs that were about romance. Bad Moon Rising, everything in a Fogerty song is some like coded symbol. Rain, for instance, is going to be social unrest, we'll stop the rain, that kind of thing. Moons represents, there's a literary sensibility. It's interesting because you have this literary sensibility with the band in terms of their lyrical content, but again, that very Spartan meat and potatoes groove, they're always in that groove. Like all of their best songs catch a kind of groove. And really, on their albums, you're not going to find any weak tracks. There aren't like any songs that you'd skip over if you were that kind of person. I'm not, but other people are. You're there for the entire duration. And life, man, things come in and intrude and change things and change people. And sometimes I'll see some posts from like John Fogerty or things he says. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of me-centric. I can see how that would have been difficult for people in his orbit. Like, right, it's not subtle, and it's not just the way he, just the way he naturally expresses himself when he's talking about things. Like, whenever he's sort of, like, mentioning something, it's like, oh, I had a song come out once called Fortunate Son. Like, can't you say we, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's like you get a little hint when his comments do pop up, like, oh, that's what happened.
Well, and the fact, too, I think it was Stu Cook from CCR who told us the story of how they did what they thought was a great set at Woodstock, but Fogerty didn't think it was up to par, and so he said, no, don't put it on the live album, don't put it in the documentary.
You can listen to it now. It's been released now,
yeah.
So you don't even have to go the bootleg route. You know what's interesting is so many bands, it seems like, said that about Woodstock. I mean, the Dead had one of their, like, most infamous sets, bad sets. You listen to it. They have other problems, like people are getting electrocuted and stuff like that. But The Who said it was the worst gig they ever did. If you can go on YouTube, the entire Who set is up. Someone put up a really nice version of it a few months ago. Listen to them play Sparks, for instance. It's hard to listen to that, and you can see the footage, too, and think, oh, yeah, I guess this was a bad night. Like, you're just not going to draw the conclusion. I think there was a disconnect at Woodstock, for whatever reason, between its cultural notoriety and what it felt like to be there and maybe what it was like to play there. And I think that soured the opinions of the people who did play there. But you listen to that set. They just weren't ever going to be, like, not that good. It wasn't going to happen. I think what happened, though, with them is it was almost like it was John Fogerty in a backing band. And
right.
That was how it was set up and marketed. That's why this Royal Albert Hall show is useful. Keep on Chuglin is useful. It's a team effort. It really is not, like, more Fogerty. That song does not work with other players. I know he's singing it, and he's playing lead guitar, and he's playing harmonica, but he might not even be, like, the main force. The collective is the main force, but it's not him for that extended number. And I think that was another issue, too, that it was, like, this guy and his backing band, whereas they were a cohesive band that needed to play together for those people to have the success artistically that they did. I mean, really, center field and all this stuff, it's silly. It's not the same. It's not close to the same level. I mean, it just isn't.
Colin Fleming with us. Check out some great West Coast rock from the late 60s. Colin, thank you as always. I hope tomorrow brings you fresh, abundant coffee wherever you stop in.
All right. Keep on chugging, Kim.
Thanks, Colin.